Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society, and I am a host on the channel. And today I am pleased to have with us Dr. R.R. Reno, the editor of the acclaimed journal First Things. Dr. Reno has a doctorate in religious ethics from Yale University, and he was an academic before becoming the editor of First Things. Today we are speaking about his book, The Return of Strong Gods, Nationalism, Populism, and the Future of the West. Welcome, Dr. Reno.
A pleasure to be with you.
Dr. Reno, what is the thesis of your book?
It's got, I would say, a historical thesis, and then I guess it's what you would say a kind of anthropological or metaphysical thesis. The historical thesis is that the political culture of the West is profoundly shaped by the civilizational trauma of 1914 to 1945, and that our political arrangements and our cultural consensus is developed in the post-war era as an attempt to prevent a recurrence of these incredibly destructive events. And I describe that as the open society consensus. And the metaphysical or anthropological thesis is that human beings unite around shared loves, and that we seek to be loyal to what I call strong gods. And so part of the populism and the sense that everything is coming undone in 2020 stems from the fact that the post-war consensus of openness has ultimately run its course and become too unworkable for human beings who desire to unite themselves in a shared love.
Can you explicate a little bit what you mean exactly by the term strong gods?
Well, I don't mean Thor or, Zeus or something like that. I take it as a metaphor. The term kind of comes from Durkheim's Elementary Forms of Religious Life, where he meditates in the concluding section of that book on modernity and the way in which modern secularism has made the old gods, and I think he uses that term, the old gods less and less plausible. And he doesn't mean Christianity, he means progress, reason, and things like that, that were the kind of gods of the Enlightenment. But he speculates that human beings need these kinds of organizing loves and that new gods will emerge. And so that's the sense in which I use the term strong gods. These are the things that Richard Weaver, in, I think it's in The Ethics of Rhetoric, has an essay on God terms. And God terms are the kind of the ones that everybody nods in assent. You know, we have to promote democracy. Progress is a God term. Reason is a God term. I think Durkheim was incorrect that those terms actually have been revived and have had a second life after the World War I and World War II.
And what exactly do you mean by the post-war consensus?
Well, in the book, I I look at Karl Popper and Friedrich Hayek. Popper's book, Open Society and Its Enemies, was written during the war by Popper, really very transparently, as an attempt to put Western culture on a new footing to prevent the return of totalitarianism. And so Popper urges a skeptical attitude towards truth. He specifically commends nominalism because it's a kind of anti-metaphysical view of truth, and urges his famous principle of falsifiability. He urges as the appropriate approach, social scientific knowledge, not metaphysical claims, should be the foundation of society. Small truths, not large truths, so to speak. Weak truths, not strong truths, is how I would put it. And then Hayek, in The Road to Serfdom, another wartime book, is not as ambitious as Open Society and Its Enemies, but is also a call for an approach to society that doesn't require any kind of organizing authority, but relies on the marketplace to provide the organizing basis for a lot of social relations. So those are the two. I take them as exemplary figures rather than specifically causing or in some way defining the post-war consensus. Because that consensus arose not from any single source, but from multiple sources.
Why was Walter Lippmann's book, Essays in Public Philosophy, widely attacked when it came out in the mid-1950s?
Yeah, well, that's a good example of how broad the consensus was. So Lippmann was also trying to diagnose the failure of Western civilization in that time of crisis from 1914 to 1945. And he came to the conclusion that a liberal society had to recover its metaphysical foundations or its foundations in natural law. And if you look at Essays in a Public Philosophy, I think as I recall, that's the title. It's a journalistic book. It's not a book of philosophy per se. But the mere fact that Lippmann kind of gestured towards the natural law tradition was interpreted by reviewers as a road to serfdom, as a entry point to a return of totalitarianism. So it's a kind of fascinating, it's a fascinating response, because Lippmann was a card-carrying progressive, founding editor of the New Republic, as I recall. So I think he was also shocked by the response, but I think he didn't recognize the new consensus. It's not one based in natural right, so to speak, a liberalism based in natural right. It was a liberalism based in a kind of openness sentiment. The same time period, you had people like Daniel Bell, his famous book from, I think, 1960, The End of Ideology. So you have a whole literature that comes in the 50s of folks thinking we can move from a politics based on arguments about what is just or what is good to a political system where we're really just basically arguing about means, technical ends, so it's kind of technocratic management of society rather than political debate.
Why, in your opinion, did William F. Buckley gradually conform to the post-war consensus?
Well, part of it was Buckley was already had the Hayekian side of things. So God and Man at Yale uses Hayek's distinction between collectivism and individualism as an organizing motif. But Buckley had a kind of double commitment. He was criticizing the Yale faculty for teaching collectivism in economics and atheism in religion. And so you can see there's a tension between, if you will, the authority of God versus the freedom of the market. And part of his genius, and one of the reasons I admire him, is that he held those things in tension, but over time, I think, developed the freedom side took priority. The sort of more libertarian side took priority. And so, as I talk about in the book, a preface that he wrote to a reissue of God a Minute, I think the 20th anniversary version, where he had very kind of argument from pluralism. What he was really trying to do is get Yale to go its own way rather than going with the herd in higher education. And that's not the argument he made in God a Minute at Yale, but it's a new argument that I think he drew upon by the time you get to the 70s or early 80s. Post-war consensus is so strong, and he was a practical man. He wanted to influence American politics and society. And at some point, you can't fight the consensus. You have to do a jujitsu with it. And that's how I interpret his conformity to the consensus.
In your telling, would it be correct to say that the liberal critique of so-called conformity in the 1950s led to the transgressions of the 1960s?
It is funny, it'd be interesting. I don't see the 60s as a disjunctive decade as compared to the 50s. If you look at David Reisman's The Lonely Crowd or the more journalistic book by White called The Organizational Man, there was a lot. Our elites were very anxious about the post-war return to normalcy, which they thought encouraged too much of a conformist character. And there was also the therapeutic mode of engaging life became very powerful in the 50s. You know, Karen Horney, Roland May, self-realization, Maslow's stages of moral development, that culminate in the post-conventional, as I recall, that's the highest form of moral consciousness. And so you can see that the students who rebelled, the college students who rebelled in the second half of the 1960s, had learned their lessons well. And they were simply carrying forward this open society consensus to the next stage.
Why do you believe that Albert Camus was an exemplar of a certain type of secular moral norm in the post-1945 period?
Because you have in Popper this notion that an open society cannot be grounded in metaphysical truths. We have to have the courage to accept the fact that we give history meaning. History itself has no meaning. And what Camus was a kind of a literary, he gave very winsome and accessible literary expressions to this particular vision of the human condition. That the existentialism of Camus is that we give life meaning, and that this is the heroic call of the mature person. They recognize that there is no God above, there are no metaphysical foundations below, and that we have to give our lives meaning. And that, he was, most people think that that's nihilism, right? That there's no, if life has no meaning, then isn't that terrible? And part of Camus' importance in the 50s is he reassured Western elites that far from being a bad fate, this was in fact a heroic call. So his novels typically turn on the people, the characters who have the moral clarity to recognize that the only foundation of humane life is our solidarity and our mere humanity, and not in some higher calling.
How exactly?
That's why he won the Nobel Prize. I mean, he's not a great writer. I mean, he's a winsome writer, but he's hardly one of the great literary masters of the 20th century. But he just played such an important role in reassuring Western elites that the open society consensus was not nihilistic, but rather it had its own kind of existential integrity.
Is that why you say that Camus and Milton Friedman, in your words, quote, have a great deal in common, unquote?
Indeed. I mean, Milton Friedman also argues very strongly against any kind of metaphysical horizon for society. Certainly, society should not. The best possible society is one with the thinnest possible conception of the good that allows people the greatest possible freedom to define life for themselves.
I notice in the book that you don't mention once T.S. Eliot, even though he was enormously influential, not only as a literary figure, but as a cultural critic in the first 15 years after the war. Why was that?
Well, that's a great question. And he's part of the counter tradition that resisted the post-war consensus, and of course he lost. So he's not part of the story. I mean, in other words, the book is not a history book in the sense of it's not a book. An adequate book about the post-war consensus would go into different strands that contribute to the dominant consensus as well as the dissenting voices of the era. And I put Eliot in the dissent in as one of the leading figures of the dissenting voices. I mean, there's a great, a very fine review of toward the idea of a Christian society by Lionel Trilling that was published in Partisan Review in the late 40s when the book came out, and in which Trilling commends to the readers of the journal, he commends the book as an important voice of dissent from the liberal consensus. That he thinks it has to be taken seriously because actually Eliot thinks there are strong gods and those strong gods need to be hearkened to, whereas the post-war consensus was trying to drive strong gods out of the public consciousness. And Trilling himself was an ambivalent figure as well, I would say. I think he was very much an avatar of this consensus in the liberal imagination. But by the time you get to the 60s, he's got some fascinating essays where he warns that nature has a say in human nature, has a say in what we, it provides limits to the openness of our society, and that we cannot, in fact, reconstruct our lives any which way we want, but that nature will put limits on us. So he's an ambivalent figure, as are probably lots of folks. I mean, as I mentioned, Richard Weaver, he would obviously be part of the dissenting tradition. Russell Kirk, Permanent Things, he's part of the dissenting tradition. Alan Tate, great literary critic, again, I think part of this dissenting tradition. The new critics, Robert Penn Warren, the new criticism, the well-wrought urn, which was such an influential, there the literary text took on, it had authority over the student and the critic, and it dictated the constraints of interpretation. And so that's why it's so important that you get to people like Derrida and others who argue that interpretation, you could say, I'm putting it crudely, interpretation creates the work. The work does not evoke interpretation.
How did the death of God theology fit in with the post-war consensus?
It was... I mean, somebody like Paul Van Buren was a kind of, or for that matter, also Harvey Cox and others, they were mainline Protestants who theologized this consensus. And so it's a paradoxical thing, right? They redefine God in such a way that God is openness. And so the genius of Christianity is to make no strong claims. So, In the in in the crucifixion of Christ, God empties himself of all divine transcendence. So it's I would call it a theological ideology of the post-war consensus. Paul Tillich does it to a certain extent also, and he uses the Lutheran doctrine of justification by faith and not by works. And already earlier on in the 19th century, liberal German Protestant theologians had interpreted the Nicene Creed and other dogmas as a kind of works righteousness, an attempt to ground Christianity in something other than the sheer act of faith. And so you can see how Tillich then takes the indeterminacy of the choice of faith and turns it into the paradigm of the Christian life. And that allows, I grew up, I was born in 1959, and as a child, they had these reading groups in my parents' church, and they were reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Letters and Papers from Prison, Tillich, Death of God Theology, and it was kind of elite mainline Protestants trying to figure out how this new consensus actually was compatible with Christianity. Because, you want to relieve the tension between what you've come to believe is obviously the intuitive truth about the way we should live with your commitment to live in accord with Christian teaching. So you get this huge cottage industry of theologians that are reinterpreting Christian teaching to make it conform to the open society consensus.
You're right that populism is more than simply a criticism of socioeconomic conditions. That is, in fact, a rejection of the post-war consensus. Can you explicate that a bit?
Well, populism is a symptom, and it's a symptom of the distrust that the ruled increasingly have of their rulers. And so you can have left populism, you can have right populism. In some ways but the proper sociological description of populism is, voters or a populace that's unwilling to accept the authority of the dominant consensus. And so it starts to eject the representatives of that consensus, or no longer hearkens to them, or no longer listens to them, no longer accepts their authority. And I think we've seen that over the last decade, probably already latent in the Tea Party stuff, and now in full bloom, left and right, as you have, protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters that, basically no longer accept the authority of the center left. And you had Trump voters who did not accept the authority of the center right when they were told that he was completely unqualified for office, and they said, well, we don't care, we're going to vote for him anyway. And then you get, James, what's the fellow at the New York Times who got ejected from his position as an editorial page editor, James Bennett, that he's saying, well, look, we have to have a free and we have to have an editorial page that allows for open debate of kind of key questions in public life. And you have the, junior staff of the New York Times saying, no, you don't. The other side is illegitimate. And that's a rejection of the older open society, an aspect of the open society consensus. Because the open society consensus, the left version was cultural and the right version was economic for the open society consensus. And you could say that, look, the more open our economy is, the more open our markets are, and this obviously came to the fore after 1989, globalization, the more open markets are to the free flow of goods, capital, and labor, the more prosperous everyone will be in the long run. And we can see that right-wing populism is rejecting the kind of neoliberal economic vision or promise that the more open things are, the more prosperous everybody will be in the long run. They're saying, well, actually, no, we want, we, we, We want to be protected from competition by immigrant labor. We want to be protected by competition from Chinese labor. We don't want capital to be able to flow or corporations to be able to locate wherever they want, pay taxes wherever they want, et cetera, et cetera. So we see a pushback from the right. And the open society consensus on the left, you know, John Stuart Mill, free marketplace of ideas, things like that, that's increasingly being challenged by the radical left as well now. So I just think it's pretty clear that, you know, people should be, the open society consensus is people should be free to define the meaning of their own lives, and would be that kind of cultural position. And political correctness is this kind of paradoxical claim that, yes, people should be free to define the meaning of their own lives, but the people who don't affirm the open society consensus as we define it are not permitted. So if you see what I mean.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
How did liberal immigration policies fit in with the post-war consensus?
I just think it was natural. You know, I think I talk in the book, one of the opening, I think it might be the opening chapter, I quote George H.W. Bush's address to the United Nations after the fall of the Berlin Wall, where he sees a future of open borders, open trade, and he says, most important of all, open minds. And so the prestige of openness is so strong in the post-war. By the time you get to the fall of communism, it's so strong that I think it's very difficult for educated people to defend borders and immigration control. I mean, most people are practically minded. They'll go, okay, well, you can't just have anarchy. But they generally think that the more freedom there is for people to move and live where they wish, the better society will be. And so the burden of proof is always on limiting immigration. And that just was not true before the post-war era. I mean, people were, you know, the industrialists wanted immigration so that there would be cheap labor to, you know, work in the steel factories in Pittsburgh. So Andrew Carnegie, I'm sure, was in favor of immigration, himself being an immigrant. But it didn't have the same moral connotations that it has now. And I think if you look at the way people think about immigration, they don't think of it as a policy issue. They think of it as almost a metaphysical commitment that open immigration is a kind of moral imperative. And I just think that's a clear symptom or sign of the power of this consensus. And also of transgenderism, the border between men and women being porous and not fixed. I believe that if you tell me what your views are on transgenderism, or if you tell me your views are on the wall that Trump, you know, made part of his campaign in 2016, that your views on the wall, if you tell me what they are, I can deduce from those views what your views on transgenderism are.
Well, in my case, that would be correct, meaning I'm, although I detest Trump, qua Trump, or qua as president, I am an adherent of firm immigration controls, and I'm following from that, I don't adhere to transgenderism.
Yep. So, I mean, it's not 100%, but I'm just saying, it's one of those, and that's what helped me when I was working on the book, or before I started the book, when I was working on the idea, trying to formulate these thoughts in my mind, it was that. I went, wow, there must be something deeper. Where did that connection come from? How is it that people, why do people's policy preferences fall so strongly on the open versus controlled axis? Open versus closed. Now, closed, of course, is a very pejorative word, and that's deliberately done that way. That's how one reason the post-war consensus works. It's people are inclusive or they're exclusive. People are open or they're closed. People are progressive or they're reactionary. you know, and it's the power of a consensus to be able to define itself in that way. Which is normal. I mean, sociologically, that's just the way things shake out. And part of the book, one of the goals of the book is to evoke for the reader the logic of the consensus. I don't tell a history in the strict sense, but I try to move historically from the immediate end of the war to the post, the after the fall of communism, and because that. I mean, obviously, the Iron Curtain was a limit, and there was a border, so to speak. And when that fell, the open society consensus really didn't face any obvious immediate limitations. And it was then that we got sort of utopian end of history thinking, which was quite powerful and evident in Bush's evocation of open borders, open trade, open borders, and open minds. And a lot of the problems that we have politically stem from the fact that the consensus, it became utopian. And I talk about the Harvard University General Education's report on the general education for a free society is the name of this report. And so it was interesting because in 1943, this committee, James Bryant Conant, the president of Harvard, formed this committee, and he was one of the civilian heads of the Manhattan Project and very much involved in the war effort. And by summer 1943, that was, Stalingrad. The Germans had been stopped at Stalingrad. It was clear the outcome of the war. And so he began to think about, well, we've got to think about how to win the peace, so to speak. And so the General Education for a Free Society is this attempt to sort of form a consensus about education of American elites that would ensure that our American elites would be able to defend democracy and, prevent the return of totalitarianism. And in that report, the leitmotif is achieving the proper balance between the authority of the Western tradition and the freedom of students to ask critical questions. So it's continuity and change. It's authority and freedom. You see that in that report. It's very artfully done. And as I said, you could see that in the new criticism in English literature, which is that the authority of the literary work, but obviously the freedom for creative interpretation within that authority. And it was a marvelous balance. And I was educated in that tradition. In the late stages of that tradition, it was the Plato to present Western civilization required class, and you read the great classics of the Western tradition, but you were really free to make up your own mind about what you thought about those classics. And what happened is that the openness and freedom side was always had the prestige, and the burden of proof was always on the continuity and authority side. And by the time you get to the late 80s and the canon wars, you know, about whether or not you should, whether or not the West, you know, hey, heave ho, the Western canon's got to go. I think that was the early 1990s protests at Stanford University to get rid of the Western, the required Western civilization course. That's just, that's the evolution of the consensus, and the balance was lost, and the openness side became predominant to the exclusion of the authority and continuity side. And my interpretation of populism, and this was true not just in education and higher education, it was true at every level of our society, in terms of our cultural outlook, in terms of our economic policies, in terms of our foreign policy. We're going to bring democracy and openness to Iraq and the Middle East. And so that lack of balance has, I think, led to this utopian openness that I think voters are rebelling against.
When did diversity and multiculturalism become important values in the West? So, for example, in his wartime writings, George Orwell, who wrote a couple of essays of importance in terms of describing what he thought the nature of Englishness was, both terms are not used or conveyed in any sense whatsoever.
Yes. Diversity has an interesting... I think Peter Wood wrote the book on diversity, which is a very useful study of the emergence of that and the prestige that that term got. But it really took on a central role in our thinking because of the Bakke decision. And the Bakke decision was 1978. It concerned racial quotas for medical school. Quota is not the right word. It had to do with medical school admissions, and a white Vietnam vet was denied admissions a couple times to University of California Medical School. But his MCAT score was substantially above the MCAT scores of, I think, all the black admits to the medical school. And so he litigated on the grounds of reverse discrimination. And the Supreme Court, the amicus brief from to the Supreme Court for that case, emphasized the importance of freedom for universities to create classes that were reflected racial and ethnic diversity, that this was conducive to a better educational environment. And Justice Powell, I think, who wrote the controlling opinion in that case, really fixed upon that. And so the notion then was that diversity is an educational good. And then very quickly, it just became a plenary good. It became what, as I said earlier in our conversation, Richard Weaver calls the God term. It's a God term. And so if you say to somebody, you know, I really like this neighborhood. It's very diverse. People are like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's good. Or there's not enough diversity. Everybody nods. I mean, this is it's a conversation stopper. The diversity word, and I think it achieved that status partly because it allowed for a way to navigate questions of justice without actually addressing them. Like, is it just are the admissions policies that deny admission to Bakke, are they just or unjust? You could kind of punt on that and say, well, that's the one question, but there's this legitimate question about what is conducive to the ideal educational environment. And so diversity allows for, but then justice is a strong God. So it's not surprising that we live in a time that tries to turn away from justice and talk about some kind of openness motif that leaves open the question. You know, and that's the beauty of diversity. Like, well, what is it? How much is good? Is there anything? Is it possible there's too much? Diverse with respect to what? All that stuff is kind of left vague. And that's, if you go all the way back to Popper, Open Society and Its Enemies, vagueness is a virtue, not a vice, because it leaves questions open. Open questions are better than closed questions.
Would it be true to say that you view nationalism in mostly a positive light?
In 2020, yes. I certainly wouldn't have thought so in the 1930s. But public life is always a question of fighting the battles of the present, not the past. There's a tendency in intellectuals and generalists, like generals, to fight the last war. And if I'm right about the open society consensus becoming all-powerful and utopian, then we need to correct in the direction of things that are solid, not fluid, things that are trustworthy and homemaking, so to speak, not diversifying and things that create ambiguity and uncertainty. So in that part of the book, I emphasize this notion of home. And, the open society consensus taken to an extreme makes all of us refugees and all of us kind of uncertain about where we fit and whether there is a home base, so to speak, where we're safe. And so it's not surprising that in the last decade, elite college students, you would think they should be the most secure people of all, given the fact that things are extremely likely to work out well for them. But they're the ones leading the charge and calling for safe spaces. And it's an indication that the open society consensus has created a kind of feeling of homelessness, lack of security, lack of clear belonging. And I think identity politics is an ersatz attempt to fill that need. Well, at least I belong to my identity group. At least there I'm home. I know who I am and where I stand. And I think it's more healthier for people to take their stand and take their identity from faith, family, and civic life rather than our DNA. Because ultimately, the DNA, I think, is a perverse strong god, not a healthy strong god. Whereas, a national identity is a strong one. I mean, is a potentially very healthy one, because it's not biological, it's political, and political realities are human, not animal.
Can you expand on the following passage in the book? Quote, "Today, the greatest threat to political health of the West is not fascism or the Ku Klux Klan, but a decline in solidarity and a breakdown of the trust between the leaders and the led."
I think we've witnessed it over the last couple of months. I was traveling in the Midwest earlier this month just to get a sense of the mood of the nation. And the mistrust is pretty deep. So the danger is that everything's going to fly apart. The danger is not that we're going to kind of over consolidate into a kind of quasi fascist state. I mean, that hardly seems the greatest threat given all of the dispersing, polarizing trends in our society. But like I said, it's the generals fight the last war, and people can't resist the analogies to the 1930s. And it's not that there aren't some. I mean, there are obviously some. I mean, the disorder, the fragmentation, the feeling that everything's falling apart, blowing apart, certainly can lead people to sort of say, I'd rather have an authoritarian strongman than a Hobbesian war of all against all. That's obviously what Hobbes recognized, that if you have to choose between anarchy and the Leviathan, you'll opt for the Leviathan. So the thrust of my book is that at the end, where I turn to where we need to go from here, is that people who responsible leadership in 2020 is to propose to the American people, and this will be true for the French people or the German people, to propose to the American people noble loves that they can share.
Would it be true to say that you are or were, when the book was written, optimistic about the future of the West? And are you still?
You know, after 9/11, I was going to meetings and talking to people who were very concerned about Islamic terrorism and the threat that it posed to the West. And they were shocked at my indifference or my nonchalance. And I asked a friend of mine, do you really believe that Islam is the greatest threat to the West? And he kind of said, no, actually, it probably doesn't pose an existential threat. And then I said, well, what is the greatest threat to the West? And he looked at me and said, the West. So we're in a paradoxical situation in the West, which is that Western culture has never been more powerful than it is now. Communism, it destroyed Confucian culture in China, and it westernized the Chinese political and cultural imagination. Not completely. It's not European. It's its own China. It's its own place with its own culture. But it's a lot closer to the West now than it was in 1950. And I think that's one mistake that James Burnham made in his famous book, The Suicide of the West. He didn't recognize that communism is a distinctively Western ideology. And multiculturalism is a distinctively, uniquely Western ideology. Diversity is a distinctly Western ideology. And these are strong, they're globally quite strong. And paired with the sort of technocratic, scientistic outlook, I think you have actually a growing westernized global consensus. So that's the one side of it. In that sense, the West is under no threat. On the other side of it, I see that Western consensus as becoming increasingly inhuman and unable to provide people with a satisfying foundation for personal or civic life. And in that sense, it's in trouble. I hope that's clear. I mean, so I guess that's not a straightforward answer. Am I optimistic or pessimistic? It's just I don't think anybody that says that we have a problem because the anti-Western bias of higher education, I just have to shake my head and say, no. That is the decadent final stage of the open society consensus, which was and has been the consensus in the West since 1945. The only people who are anti-Western are Westerners, people of the West.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
That's a great question. The one thing I want them to take, two things I would say. One, and I think I've alluded to it, I just spoke about, is I want them to achieve some analytic clarity so that they don't fall into so that they're able to see the crisis of our time in the proper way. And that crisis really is a crisis of what I would call a crisis of home. People don't feel that they have a solid place to stand, personally, culturally, or economically. And then the second thing I want people to take away is that the responsible leaders have to give people a firm place to stand. And that we are not going to, I don't think the future is the battle between authority and freedom or what have you, but or between fascism and liberalism. I think the coming struggle will be between perverse loves and healthy ones, perverse loyalties and healthy loyalties, perverse foundations for a common life and healthy ones, perverse authorities versus healthy authorities, to put it in those terms.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Dr. Reno, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to the New Books Network. Thank you, Dr. Reno.
Great. Well, enjoy your day.